We should get started. Thank you all for being patient. And I'm Dan Rundy. I hold the Schreier Chair here at CSIS. I wanted to do a conversation on what's called Trends in Democratization of Sub-Saharan Africa. My friends in the national intelligence community put out a very interesting report. I think one of the reasons I wanted to do this was that the number of hoops they have to jump through to put stuff out that's unclassified is just enormous. And we've got some unbelievably talented, thoughtful experts in the intelligence community who are thinking about global trends, and you're going to have a chance to hear about that shortly. But as part of that process, they have this every 4 years, they produce a product called Global Trends, and then they produced a short paper associated with Global Trends that talked about the contestation that you're going to hear about shortly, but sort of the different kind of forces that you're going to see in Africa. One of the other reasons I wanted to do this was there's been a bit of a democracy recession largely, except in Africa's a little bit of going in a different direction. There's been larger democratization, but there's contestation in Africa, and so you're going to hear about this. So I wanted to have my friends Aaron Sikorsky, who's Deputy Director of the Strategic Futures Group at the National Intelligence Council, is going to, along with Alexis Smallridge, who's the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for West Africa, part of the National Intelligence Council. The two of them are going to present the findings to kind of kick off this discussion. Then we've got a conversation we're going to have among some very thoughtful people who are going to be able to kind of unpack or sort of respond to what they've heard. So I'm going to ask my friends from the National Intelligence Council to come up here and present their findings. Please welcome them and give them a big warm round of applause. Okay. Yeah. So I don't know. Are you guys, do you have wireless? Are you not mic'd? Okay. So I think you should just do that and then maybe you can share. I'll have my friends, the panelists, I think we have them. Wait.
Great. Well, thank you everyone so much. I really appreciate everyone coming today. I'm Alexis Smallridge, the Principal Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Africa. And I'm joined here by Aaron Sikorsky from our Strategic Futures Group. I'm not sure how familiar everyone actually is with the National Intelligence Council. So we're just going to kick off with a very quick overview of what we do, who we are. We're the intelligence community center for long-term strategic analysis under the Director of National Intelligence. We serve three main functions. First, we're a bridge between the intelligence and policy communities, and we represent the intelligence community's voice in the policy process. We also facilitate outreach, essentially what we're doing today. This session is actually not just for us to tell you about what we've found in this report, but also to solicit your reactions. That back and forth and feedback is really important in our analysis, especially from academics and from the public world. And finally, as I mentioned, we do strategic and long-term analysis, and we pull together viewpoints from across the intelligence community and present that united viewpoint on what we see for the future of the world. And I'm going to ask Aaron to just give a couple quick words about what the Strategic Futures Group does. It's a big part of our presentation today.
Sure. Thank you, Alexis. So the Strategic Futures Group is responsible for multidisciplinary over-the-horizon analysis for the NIC. Multidisciplinary over the horizon analysis 5 to 20 years out. And a key product that we put out is the Global Trends Report, which comes out every 4 years, an unclassified look at the future targeted toward new or returning administrations. And this paper, which Alexis is going to present, is a part of the Global Trends project. So I'll speak a little bit more about that later, but this conversation will help us think about what questions we should be asking for the next Global Trends report.
Great, thank you, Aaron. So I'm going to quickly step through the highlights from our democratization report. I'm actually going to do this as a fairly quick overview because I do want to make sure we have plenty of time for Q&A and for interaction with all of you. So I would reference anyone certainly to read the full report, which I think is both on CSIS's website as well as on the Global Trend website linked to the NIC. So definitely please take a look at the full report for more questions or if you want to hear more about this in depth. I'm just going to highlight four key points that I want to emphasize when we're thinking about democratization in Africa. First, what we're seeing right now on the continent. We're seeing heightened competition over the nature of democracy. Second, I'm going to talk about what do we see going forward, what's our outlook through 2022. And that's a continued tug of war between democratic and authoritarian politics. Then, I'm actually going to talk a little bit about the outside and the Western perspective. That's the perspective from which we write and what's important when we inform policymakers. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how the West is facing continued pressure to referee these electoral contests and to referee democratization in Africa, and also talk about a little bit of the trade-offs that the West faces between security assistance and democratization, democracy and governance assistance. So that's going to be the outline of our talk today. So the first point that I really want to talk about, which is the persistent volatility that we're seeing right now on the continent. These are the trends that we're observing today. First, we do see that commitment to democracy is very strong on the continent. 80% of Africans express support for democracy. That's up from 65% a decade ago. And we're really seeing that this commitment to democracy is very strong on the continent. However, public satisfaction in the state and with governance in Africa is down. Africans express low trust in formal institutions, and they're turning to traditional and religious leaders to channel grievances. This clash is leading to a wave of protests that we're seeing across the continent. For example, in 2015, nearly half of all countries in Africa experienced protests, and that's three more times than occurred in 2014. So protests are actually increasing, and it's because of this clash between really expectations and what people are actually getting in their daily lives. I also want to highlight in this point that these protests are successful. When we looked back at the three dozen large-scale, nonviolent anti-government campaigns in Africa since the 1940s, two-thirds of them were successful at removing a leader, and 10% achieved major concessions. That's a very high success rate. So I think many times we have a conception of African protests where they happen for two or three days and fade away, and major concessions aren't won. When you look over history and at large-scale protests, that's actually not true, and there is quite a bit of success that's achieved by people on the ground. The second trend we're seeing right now in what's happening on the continent is economic woes are weakening states. The commodity price downturn in 2013, 2014 has had a huge impact on patronage systems on the continent. It's led to economic stagnation, particularly in some of the larger nations, and it's reducing the traditional support bases for governments. We may see this trend be ameliorated a little bit over the next few years as commodity prices pick back up again, but it's something to really keep an eye on when we're thinking about the state of democracy on the continent. In a place with very high population growth rates, a growth rate of 2 or 3%, which is what we see in countries like Nigeria or South Africa, it's really tough to bring quality of life gains to people with those kinds of growth rates. Third, technology is really a double-edged sword, and we're seeing it used that way right now in Africa. Africa is a place where there is huge adaptation of the internet and of smartphones. Nearly 80% of Africans have smartphones. Internet access has actually tripled from 2010 to 2017, and that's the fastest growth rate in the world. And publics are using this access to actually pressure governments more efficiently and more effectively. But on the other hand, governments are also using it to pressure activists. And we're seeing a lot of governments resort to blunt tactics, shutting down internet access and other media outlets, totally restricting access to the internet, and looking to states experienced in internet control, like China or Iran, to control online spaces. And that's a very interesting trend that we're watching right now. Finally, we are seeing Western powers pulling back from democracy promotion. Africans' European partners under stress from Brexit, increased migration, domestic terrorism, economic woes, are also becoming more inwardly focused and security focused when they think about assistance to Africa. We also think about China when we think about this trend, and we do see China playing a more prominent role in democracy on the continent, and that may create a more permissive environment for African leaders to maintain power. However, I really don't want to sort of cast China as the evil knight here. I think we've seen examples on the continent where China's has had a generally pragmatic approach in Zimbabwe or South Sudan, for instance, where China's really disinclined to shore up African autocrats that are faltering and losing. So I think we want to be certain in this report and when you're thinking about this talk today that, you know, we don't think very one-dimensionally about China, because that's certainly not what we're seeing on the continent. So with that, I want to move on and talk a little bit about the outlook and what we see going forward over the next 5 years. We expect to see a tug of war between democratic and authoritarian politics across the continent. When we look at democracy in Africa, we actually don't see this sort of tug of war in fully democratic or fully authoritarian states. There's always some competition over the rules of the game in any democratic state, as well as any authoritarian state. But where we really see this focused is in those states that are neither fully free or neither fully authoritarian. And this is competition over the rules of the game. One academic I really like was talking about this, and he called it lawfare, where governments and publics are using the institution and rules in place to really compete over how you actually play the democracy game. And this is actually, I think, a good sign. You know, you can look at some of the rankings, Freedom House rankings for civil liberties, and you see those slipping in Africa. I actually think this is not a sign of democratic slippage, democratic decline. It's actually a sign that these contests are close. And when there are close elections, that means there will be government pushback. So in some ways, this tug of war between democracy and authoritarian politics is, I think, a positive sign when we look forward for democracy in Africa. I just want to step through a couple of the issues under this point. First, we do see that executive power in Africa will continue to eclipse non-executive institutions. I think this is something that we've seen over the past 40 or 50 years in Africa. It's backed by constitutions that give outsized prerogatives to the president. But we are seeing some, I think, positive signs on this front, where we see African parliaments emerging as key players in many countries. Likewise, the same thing with judiciaries. I think Kenya is the example that's on everyone's mind. We talk about the judiciary in Africa. And we see courts across the continent deciding core political questions now: presidential elections, disputes, corruption trials of presidents, third term disputes, constitutionality of anti-terrorism statutes, for instance. And this is, I think, a newer trend that we are seeing over the past few years. As with legislatures and parliaments, judiciaries are also meeting with government pushback when they move into this space. We've seen judges face politically motivated charges, pushing them off the bench, or even physical intimidation and threats. So this tug of war, I think, is very evident when you're talking about the judicial space. Civil society is also becoming increasingly vibrant, enabled by technology. Citizens are communicating more broadly across geographic lines. Some of the protest groups that we saw in West Africa and Burkina Faso, I think, are really great examples of where we see this happening in Africa. But the same point I made earlier about technology holds true here. Governments are pushing back on civil society. We're seeing the adherence to civil liberties by partial democracies in Africa is at its lowest point since the 1990s. So this is this political competition point that we're really seeing take place. And in this case, it is actually resulting in a decline in civil liberties. But that's because civil societies are speaking up more. Separately, I did want to mention political parties. They're obviously very important when you look at democracy in Africa. Historically, political parties have been fairly weak personalist in Africa and organizationally shallow. And this hobbles opposition parties when they're really facing already tilted electoral fields. It also allows for a lot for corruption to play a much bigger role in electoral politics, especially in opposition politics, where opposition parties don't have access to the resources of the state. And it means that they have to look to businessmen, they have to look to people who are independently wealthy to run and fund their own campaigns. And that brings money into politics in a way that can sometimes be unhealthy for the long-term health of the opposition party and for the political system. So it's just a point that we kind of watch as we look forward over the next 5 years. Now I'm going to move and I'm going to talk a little bit about the, if I can get the slide to advance. I'm going to talk a little bit about the outside perspective and the role of the West in Africa. We do see the West facing continued public pressure to referee electoral contexts and to promote democracy in Africa from African publics. But at the same time, we are also seeing African governments, including key U.S. partners like Uganda, Ethiopia, and Kenya, push back against U.S. and Western involvement in their domestic space, lashing out for perceived political domestic interference. I want to, I think there's a section in the report on this, but I want to highlight right now that the virtues of democracy in Africa are clear. We have the definition of democracy we use in the report. You can refer to that if you have questions about what we mean when we talk about democracy. But democracy, when you look at academic studies, is strongly linked to economic growth, strongly linked to better quality of life, and strongly linked to better civil liberties, more inclusive governance. So those are the virtues that are linked with democracies in Africa, and I think we do see some signs in Africa and examples where Africans are linking more traditional forms of governance to democracy in a really positive way. So I think we want to make sure here that we're not saying, you know, this is the Washington version of democracy. We are certainly talking about, what Africans perceive to be democracy, and there are more definitions and writing about this in the report itself. So I encourage people with questions about that to take a closer look there. I did, though, want to mention something that's really interesting as we look at it from the policymaker perspective and from Washington's perspective. The spread of democracy, while it is a good thing, creates challenges for Washington. And this is something that we really think about as we look at the future of the continent looking forward, since we've seen this slow trend over the past 30 years of more countries in Africa becoming democratic. As countries become democracies, it disrupts the existing power dynamics. This certainly can be a good thing, but it's also, you know, when it's a country where Washington or the West has a long-term relationship with the leader in place, for example, in Uganda or Rwanda, it does disrupt that relationship that the outside state has with that country. That's not a bad thing, but it is a challenge that a policymaker has to think about when they're thinking about how to make policy. Additionally, democracy also brings with it things like populism, which, again, is not neither a good nor bad thing, but it does create a broader group of stakeholders in African countries that can push initiatives or can lobby for things that aren't necessarily Western goals. For example, here we talk in the paper about LGBTI initiatives in Africa and what the history of those has looked like over the past few years, with more empowered legislatures and civil society groups becoming, I think, a little more powerful. So that's what we have in mind when we talk about creating challenges for the West. Finally, I also wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about this trade-off between democratization efforts and security goals, including counterterrorism. This is something that's obviously very important for the United States, but it's also important for Europe and for other outside powers as they're engaging in Africa. African leaders are facing potent and legitimate security threats, so we don't in any way mean to downplay the security threats that African leaders and countries face. And I would point out that security is actually a leading concern for African publics when you look at polling by Afrobarometer, for instance. So it's a public concern as well. However, we are seeing some leaders take advantage of a more robust security apparatus funded by outside money to consolidate their hold on power. In some states, Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, Tanzania have used the threat of terrorism to crack down on opponents. And I think we certainly don't mean to cast, you know, security assistance and democracy assistance as completely opposed to each other. In well-crafted security assistance programs, you're also helping democracy at the same time. But we wanted to raise it as something that we think policymakers and the broader public should be aware of when you're thinking about what we're looking at in Africa in terms of democratization, and when we're thinking about Western involvement in the continent. It's certainly something to keep in mind going forward. I did want to close by just sort of, I think, underlining the importance of the volatility that we're talking about in this report. Africa is, I think, a hugely important part of the global future. 25% of the world will be African by 2050. And Africa has played a very small role. I think 1% of world trade is in Africa. It's played a fairly small role in world affairs so far when you're thinking about things like global trade. But with this population boom, that is certainly going to change. We've absolutely already seen African culture take on a more prominent and important role. I hope everyone in the room has seen Black Panther. Focus. This is the reason why we did this report, why we're focusing on Africa. This is the future. We're talking about the future of the world when we talk about Africa. And the volatility we see going forward is really a unique opportunity and opening for the West to forge ties with the next set of African leaders and to shape political reform in a region that's going to be hugely important when we talk about the next 50 or 100 years.
Great. Aaron, do you want to add any color commentary?
Sure. I had just a couple comments on the broader Global Trends project for folks and kind of where we're going with this here. As I said, we publish Global Trends every 4 years since 1996. It's completely unclassified, and it's a way to help shape new and returning administrations' views about the challenges they're going to face 20 years out. And many of the things that Alexis spoke about specifically in this report were overall trends we found globally, that the nature of power is shifting. We see states facing more external and internal challenges. And as publics demand more from their governments, as Alexis talked about, states are really grappling with how do we deal with the proliferation of actors within our countries who have these powers. And so now what we're looking at is, okay, this is the competition we're facing in these states. Now looking again 20 years out, where do we see these competitions going? And we're in the process of having a series of conversations both inside and outside government to think about where we go in the next Global Trends report. And we had a conversation internally a few weeks ago about Africa in particular, and I just wanted to put a few of the themes we highlighted on the table for discussion today. So a couple things that came up in our discussion is, how do we see regional institutions potentially stepping up to take roles in democracy promotion as perhaps the West pulls back in some cases? How do we see the growing capabilities of local and city governments in grappling with some of these governance challenges as state governments perhaps don't have the resources? And how do we see shifting political and social identities among African publics impacting politics and governance going forward? So I just wanted to highlight those before the panel comes up for the conversation, because what I'll be listening for today is key research questions, key things we need to be looking at going forward, both for Global Trends and other projects specifically related to Africa in the Africa NIO shop. So
I'll
have that.
I want to take advantage of the fact that the both of you are interested. I want to offer the audience a chance, and I'm going to pick maybe two or three questioners. If you're short, that's good. So who wants to raise their hand? And I'll bunch some questions together. I'd love to hear from my friend, Ambassador Ruperez from Spain, but I'd love to hear from one or two people from the continent of Africa to respond to this. Hands, please. Let me see some hands. Okay. So the gentleman in the blue tie back there, my friend Ambassador Ruperez, I'd like one other person, please. All right. And this woman back here in the back there, okay? So let me start with, okay, so everyone, name, organization, short, okay? And we're gonna get three of them and give my friends a chance to respond, then we gotta go to the panel. Sir?
Dennis Foretier, Foretier Foundation. Very great report regarding trends. I think one of the issues I want to raise is that most of these governments are not willing to open up the space So this fight is because lots of folks have been there for a long time. I'm from Cameroon, and Cameroon is a great example of what you're talking about right now. The lack of expansion of space is causing a lot of expulsion of people from the society, from the gains, and that's what's leading to a lot of the security challenges that you're talking about.
Fatima Taki, the National Guard Bureau International Affairs. My question is about minorities and ethnic conflicts in Africa. Where do you see that going, since it's one of the big drivers of, you know, wars in on the continent? Thank you.
Thank you. When looking at the map, you realize that when you talk about Africa, you are talking about sub-Saharan Africa. But at the same time, don't you feel that, I mean, given the fact that quite a number of African sub-Saharan countries have a common border with the northern African countries, there should be some sort of common interaction and common study on how the whole African continent is behaving? Thank you.
Great, thank you everyone, I really appreciate it. I'm gonna take the questions in reverse, starting with the ambassador from Spain. When we talk about North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa, historically there's actually been a fairly clear, I think, dividing line where people tend, especially in political science, not to look at the two together. We definitely think that's changed, particularly since the Arab Spring in Tunisia. When the Arab Spring happened, you saw a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa talking about what it meant for them, what are the lessons they could take from that. And I think you also now see North African countries looking south, particularly, you know, with Morocco in the African Union. It's a huge question right now where Morocco in particular, but the other North African states as well, are participating more in African institutions in the African Union. And I think looking to what's happening in Africa to take their example, more so than we've actually seen in the past. And of course, you know, I mean, I think Libya is a huge example of, or the conflict there, has had large effects on all across the Sahel and that part of Africa, and it's, I think, brought those ties much more into relief and much more open than they've been discussed in the past. It's absolutely a great point, great question. On the minorities question, when we look at academic studies of what's good or bad for democracy in Africa, we actually find that corruption and ethnic polarization are two significant things that are highlighted as being bad for democracy, so to speak. So this question of ethnic polarization is really important. And when there's actually a section in the report about this, so I encourage you to look at that. But when we're talking about how to be more inclusive, how to bring in minority ethnic groups, democracy is the best way to do that, and democracy is much more tied to inclusive politics. But there's certainly a right and a wrong way to do it. When you're talking about, for instance, federal systems, which are an important way to bring in minority ethnic groups and ensure minority participation in the system, in Africa we see federal systems be a lot more successful when they're actually set up by a democracy than when they're set up by an authoritarian state. I think maybe the sort of Nigeria and the Congo examples are important here. In Congo Kinshasa, you know, we've seen decentralization, but it hasn't been particularly helpful for bringing in minority viewpoints. But when you look at countries like, say, Nigeria, there is much more of an open system for minority ethnic participation. So that's certainly, those are a couple of the factors we think about when talking about minority participation and ethnic polarization, which are both key points for democracy going forward. And finally, the point about governments not willing to open up space. I didn't talk about it in the public presentation. We do talk about it a little bit in the report. But term limits are a really important part of this conversation when you're talking about leaders being in power for long periods, particularly, for example, Cameroon with Paul Biya. And when we look at democracies, the average African leader has been in power in a democracy for, I think it's about 2.5 or 2.6 years. But when you look at authoritarian states, the average is 17 years. So there's a clear tie there between democracies, authoritarian states, and the idea of term limits, which has been really controversial and very much talked about in Africa over the last few years. Term limits, I think, I don't want to be too strong about tying term limits to democracy, but it is an important indicator. It allows youth, having term limits in place allows youth, allows new politicians to participate a lot more in a system, and it helps build a much more stronger democracy, prevents, you know, situations where the leader dies in office and there's no system in place to account for that. So term limits, I think, is an important part of this discussion and something that I can certainly talk more about if we have more interest from the audience.
Okay, great. All right, we're going to do a set change. If at the NIC, when you get to take a job, like, do you get a smoke screen or an ejector seat in your car? That's what they wanted to know. It's smoke screen, you go for smoke screen? Okay, that's great. Or oil slick. All right, thanks. So I got some really smart friends of mine to help us unpack this, because I think this is an important report. So you've heard the report. And so I wanted some folks who do this for a living or think about this for a living to be with us and to kind of respond to this. So first, I've got to my left Bill Sweeney, who's the president and CEO of the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. So, and I'll just Bill, what is, just could you just give a 1 minute infomercial for what is IFAS and why is this, why did I want you here to respond to this, and what do you think about this?
All in 1 minute?
All in 1 minute. All in 1 minute.
Okay, talk fast.
Talk fast.
IFAS, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, is part of the democracy movement. Our focus, our clientele, are election management bodies. We work with those public servants who've been appointed by their governments to conduct an election. Conducting an election is a complicated thing, just as electricity is more than turning on a light switch. So on election day, we will have trained 10 people per polling station. For many of these countries, you're talking about over 500,000 people being trained. We will have worked with the Election Commission in terms of ballot design, ballot forensics, voter identification, voter registration, tabulation, transmission of results, and then finally the broadcast of the results to the entire population. We will work with the court system on how you deal with electoral dispute resolution, recounts, challenges of fraud, challenges of malpractice, including, for example, in Kenya, where the Supreme Court basically decided that the Election Commission had failed in its duties in terms of collection of election materials post-election, and thus invalidated the entire presidential election. So that entire process, which is a cycle, it's much more than an event, also involves working with security forces in terms of deployment of police and military and increasingly cyber intelligence so that the election system and the systems that are maintained on ICT systems are safe, transparent, accountable, and effectively used.
Sorry, just a leading question. Does the U.S. government support your work?
Yes. The U.S. government has been, USAID and the State Department have been longtime supporters of IFAS in its 31 years of existence. We also receive support from the foreign aid departments of Australia, Britain, Canada, Denmark, the European Union, Sweden, Norway, Germany, and a few other United Nations as well as others.
But the United States is a big supporter of this.
Over 70% of our funding this year is from USAID.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so you see this, you hear these thoughts. What are just a couple of
What are some big, just some takeaways for this audience, given what you've just described of what IFAS is and how it works on the continent, to this report? What's your take?
Okay, two or three quick points. Number one, I would like to have seen election management bodies included as one of the actors or actresses on the stage. These are very, very important bodies. They are trusted with maintaining the information through a more advanced identification system than anything in the United States that's used on Election Day for voter registration, for then allowing people to vote and counting the votes. The role of election management bodies is something that is very much part of the tug of war. Some of them are enshrined in the Constitution, some of them are election law. All of them are usually appointed in some fashion by the executive, sometimes with consultation with political parties, sometimes consultation with the parliament. These are enormously important public officials in their countries, all of them having what would be virtually the rank of cabinet or just under the cabinet if they were here in the United States. Number two, as we look at displaced populations throughout Africa, a political issue is always how do they vote. Sometimes it is because you've got a million people from Somalia who've been living in Kenya in camps for 20 years, and should they participate if Somalia goes to elections? Sometimes it's pressure from the diaspora that's sending home money every week or every month and says they want to have a voice. It's a complicated vote. It's an expensive vote. IFAS has run such programs in about 10 countries. It is going to be a larger and larger political issue in Africa. Final point I'd like to make is youth. We know from global political science studies that you have to get people voting early to build a culture of democracy, and particularly in a continent like Africa, where 10% of the world's population by 2050 is going to be under 24. So we're going to be talking about how do you register people, perhaps registering people at 15 and 16 years of age, in anticipation of a national election 2 or 3 years later, how you involve them in civic education, how you bring them to the culture of democracy, because if you don't bring them early, then when they come in, they're mad. And that usually is not a positive fact when you want to talk about what's going to happen to governments. Final point I'm going to make is I think using the term West as a referee is embellishing the role. These are sovereign countries with sovereign political parties, sovereign governments. My experience is the West can be a provider of assistance, sometimes guidance, sometimes counsel, but they're not a referee, and they shouldn't be a referee. And the other point I'd make, as we see democracy assistance go down in terms of the percentage of money that all development agencies are spending, particularly in Africa, if you want to be a referee, you got to play all four quarters. And all too often, we see a democracy project end on Election Day or shortly thereafter, and then if the next election is 4 or 5 years away, well, we'll get to that 4 or 5 years from now. There isn't the type of sustainability in this space that there is in others.
Okay, so Bill, just let me just ask one more leading question. Okay, so if you got to train 500,000 people, can you do, if someone at an aid agency, I'm just saying, let's say like AID or an embassy, say the U.S. embassy, came to IFAS and said, hey, I need you to slap together an election thing in 3 months' time, is that doable or is that crazy?
Crazy.
Okay, just so we're just clear on that, okay? So having a little bit of timing and kind of having some that's an important thing, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so okay,
I'll
great.
Give me one word answers, that's what you want,
this
right?
Is, love this, all I'm right. Loving this. Okay, Shauna Vader Blau, you're the executive director of the Solidarity Center. I know what the Solidarity Center is, but I bet many people in this audience don't know what it is. I know there's this thing called the National Endowment for Democracy, and you're a NED institute, a NED institution. So could you explain what's the NED, what's the Solidarity Center, and how does the Solidarity Center work in Africa? And then I want to ask you, what do you think about this report? But let's do a 1 minute infomercial about all that.
Yeah, sure, thank you. Actually, the Solidarity Center is part of a 100-year tradition of the American labor movement in building global solidarity for workers on behalf of workers and to promote fair economies and also more just societies. So that's what the Solidarity Center is part of a 100-year American tradition. We were also a key in founding of the NED, in fact.
Absolutely.
And And so from the origins of the National Endowment for Democracy, we've been a core institute of the NED and have played an active role in ensuring that in a global context and also in the US context, that people understand really clearly that workers and their representatives through their trade unions is a core part of democracy and helps deliver more fair economies for people.
Lane Kirkland mm-hmm. was the head of the AFL-CIO, which was the National Labor Union movement here in the United States. And he was a big proponent of democracy promotion and was a partner in standing up the NED institutions, right?
He was a big, he was a well-known figure in the United States and globally for his democracy advocacy. I would say in the, you know, in the post-Cold War American democracy promotion context, the AFL-CIO has continued to play as strong a role as it did at since the founding of the NED in building global norms and standards for workers around the world so that we all compete on a more even playing field globally and have a say in creating more just societies that we all live in.
How do you all work in Africa?
We are very proud and honored to have several offices across Africa. Just a bigger context, the Solidarity Center works in 60 countries around the world on every continent. We're a worker rights advocacy as well as capacity building organization. And our partners are both trade unions and also other parts of civil society that support the idea that labor rights are core to creating more just societies, more fair democracies for people. So about half our partners around the world are trade unions, and about the other half are supporting civil society organizations, lawyers' networks, women and feminist groups that support the labor movement. In Africa, we are working in about 15 countries in sub-Saharan yeah. Africa and across all of North Africa. And we have offices, regional presence, and we are long-term partners with our colleagues in labor movements from Swaziland, South Africa, in Senegal, across all of the continent, in East Africa, Kenya. We have increasingly over time, the global labor movement has become increasingly concerned, and this goes to a comment on the report, in fact, with, of course, the rising wealth and income inequality between states and within states. This is a massive issue in Africa. On the one hand, our great victories as a global community and the great victories of African nations in advancing economic progress and lifting so many out of poverty, but the inequality problem is still massive. It leads to a lot of disenfranchisement and unhappiness with systems and distrust in political institutions, which the report describes as like when people start to distrust systems anywhere in the world, from the United States to Kenya, you have a tendency to have people lose a little bit more faith in democracy. So what we want to advocate for is, of course, democracies that deliver. And inequality, huge inequality in wealth and income, and the inability of people to pull themselves and their families out of abject poverty through employment that's decent, fair, and where they can advance over time, is a massive potential drag in the future on democracy. And I'm sure that in your longer report on like looking into the 20 and 30 year future, the question of wealth and income inequality is a big one. You know, I would also say for us, another thing on the report would be, you know, we feel there's a really important focus on women and women's economic and political empowerment that could be, you know, could be considered missing. You know, just coming at it from this income inequality, most women in Africa and around the world work outside the home for pay for someone else if they work. They're a domestic worker in an African context. Domestic work, agricultural employment are huge sources of income. Also, the public sector disproportionately is female. And too much of our employment for women in sub-Saharan Africa is low wage, not decent work, temporary and contract work, and also burdened by a disproportionate burden on the unpaid family and home care work that women shoulder the burden of as well. So that means if you're an agricultural worker in South Africa, in wine or in any other agricultural product, you have a 1 in 3 chance of being violently sexually assaulted or abused at work. And when work is a site of violence and indignity, and work is where you spend 12 and 13 hours of your day, has a huge drag on people's ability to participate politically, raise their own political and economic status in a country, come together and form organizations that can fight back, like trade unions or like women's organizations. And so we think a focus on like gender inequality, and in particular the question of gender violence, is really critical. You know, this is of course a global phenomenon. We're talking about Africa, present in Africa, but present around the world as well, as a critical challenge for the question of inequality and gender equality.
Thanks. So, Shauna, just so folks understand, how is the Solidarity Center? How does it fund its work?
The Solidarity Center works with funding from the National Endowment for Democracy. We have a partnership with USAID and the State Department. We work with private foundations. The U.S. labor movement also supports the work of the Solidarity Center and individual contributors who care about building a global labor movement to promote fairness and grassroots democracy around the world.
Let me just press just a little bit further on this, just so that folks understand. So between the NED and AID and U.S. government, what percentage of your budget is from the U.S. government?
It fluctuates. It's in the high 80s% of overall for the U.S. government.
So the important point I want to make here is these are two organizations that are independent and do independent technical work, but the United States, through a variety of different mechanisms, supports this work and is in line with what the report is talking about, and that is why I wanted them on the stage. Okay, thank you. Dr. Adibe, thanks for being here. Dr. Adibe, you're a professor of the Department of Political Science at DePaul University. You've had a long and distinguished academic career thinking about issues of democratization in Africa. You've had fellowships at Harvard. You've also got a PhD in Canada. You're Ghanaian?
No.
You're not Ghanaian? Because I'm looking at here and it says you're at the University of Ghana in 1993.
Yes.
Are you Nigerian?
Yes.
Okay. So you're pan-West African.
Pan-African.
You're pan-African. And your work is not just in West Africa, it's pan-African in nature. And so I know our friends in the intelligence community said, gosh, we really like Dr. Adibe's stuff. He writes a lot about similar issues that we've been reading about and have influenced our report. So thanks for coming from Indiana to be with us. So could you just talk a little bit about some of the stuff you've been working on in your research? And then what's your reaction to this report, given your long, distinguished academic career?
Thank you very much, David. Sorry, my voice is lost a little bit. I came in from Nigeria last night.
Thank you for coming.
That was at conferencing and then had some flight issues, so please bear with me. I am particularly fascinated by, in my research, how Africans, despite all odds, and I want to emphasize that, despite all odds, push along. And they've done so well. We have not emphasized what they've achieved as much as we've emphasized what they have not achieved. So that's really my work. And in the areas of governance, the management of political systems in a very complex world and an increasingly complex world, and economic transformation. Anyone who is familiar with Africa, and I see a few Africans here, whether you're looking at West Africa, or you're looking at Central Africa, Rwanda was mentioned here. Oh, I think it was in the earlier meeting.
Yeah.
You cannot help but be amazed by the level of economic transformation that is ongoing in Africa. It is phenomenal. I left Nigeria in 1989. I don't know very many people who even knew anything about a computer. Today, Nigerian youths are coding in Lagos, okay? Cell phones, Kenyans use cell phones in a far more sophisticated way than I or you use cell phones in the United States. And yet we see these general discourse about Africa being down. And so I like to stay in the middle. There's a lot of things that are going wrong in Africa, but there's an awful lot that are doing well. And I think I really want to thank Nick. Your report has been superb. I had the privilege through Dr. Fry of being involved in your previous report, and I was very pleased to see this one. In terms of going forward, and I want to just get into that. There are aspects of your report that I found profoundly informative. The graph that you got that shows the trend. So we've got democracy inching up. And I think in the past year, it's fallen. And then autocracy going down between 2000 and 2015, 18. And about 2015, a year ago, you see it inching back up. I think that is the critical period. And we have to ask, why is that? And the answer to that is complex. The big elephant in the room is macro. Africa is, of all the continents, the one that is most susceptible to macro political as well as macro economic changes. It goes way back. Today, I think my biggest fear with intelligence community and government apparatus in DC is that this city and this country is changing a lot. And we are trying to understand what those changes mean, but they are having tremendous reverberations outside of this country. If people outside of here think that the United States is walking back from the democratic path, and I see that in the report, generally west, we move west, just see the United States, please. It encourages authoritarian tendencies elsewhere. Some of these are habits, they are cultural. A lot of what you see in African leadership actually is more habitual than it is legal or institutional. Big men move around and they think everybody must follow them, right? You see some of that body movement in the United States, and you say, yeah, finally we have somebody in power who really understands. He's draining the swamp, he's whipping everybody to shape. So laws and institutions, and that's where the biggest threat, in my view, really comes from. That exemplary behavior that he once had, where notwithstanding the quality of elections in Africa, but he always had the encouragement of the United States, trained diplomats, and folks who genuinely were invested in the welfare of African democracies to make some progress. If that is weakened, then we're going to have a lot of reversals. And that's my biggest fear. Where is the support structure in Washington, D.C.? The second thing I want to touch on is Bill's point about the democracy. Elections are a highly technical affair. I don't know how much people really understand that. Maybe in this country, we've taken it for granted. You go to DMV, you get registered, and you may go out on the day of voting, or you may not. You use a public transport system on your way back from work. It's not that way in Africa for all kinds of structural reasons. People don't just go register because they want to get registered at DMV. There is probably even no DMV. Electoral commissions produce a schedule. In Nigeria, where I come from, that's a big deal. Look at the order of elections. Are we going to have presidential elections first, or National Assembly elections first, and then governors, and then state assemblies? What's the big deal? Why can't you have them on the same day, right? Well, we can manage it. It's way too big. Okay, then so where do we begin? Well, the reason why it's problematic is that if you vote presidency first, election is over, right? Everyone else forget it. The big boss has won, therefore don't bother, go for it. Is it therefore that they deliberately rigged the election? No, but they are sending a message. So working with the umpires on these technical things becomes really very important. I think, Bill, that's where your work really comes in. Voter registration, following through on supporting political parties. And on that, I want to cite a work that was done by two colleagues I have at Dan. Steve Levinsky, actually, and Dan Ziblatt, on How Democracies Die. It's really a very important book, and it's for our time. Political parties are absolutely important to a democracy. One of the things they do really, really well is values. They create common values. African political parties have yet to mature. And so it's based on personalities rather than values. And I point this out because we're beginning to have the same problems here. We once thought that our political parties were so entrenched and had values, and then you have a hostage takeover of a political party and everything is up in the air. So we've got to invest a little bit more in political parties, in training political parties, in ensuring that their leadership is strong enough to produce candidates that the people can actually vote for.
Good.
Can I make one more comment?
Yes, sir.
Hopefully we're going to come back to the general. Your report, there's this tension between democracy and governance. Some say, well, we should focus more on governance than democracy. I think it's a false tension. I think they're actually together. If democracy is about elections, right, the ability of people to vote for their leaders and remove them, and governance is about providing for the needs of the people, if you ask many Africans, what we know as democracy is actually not very good. In other words, it doesn't provide for those things. Because, look, democracies are very expensive. Political parties have to hire lawyers, strategies, and they spend a lot of money on them rather than providing for water, right? A military government does not have to have a Senate. In other words, legislators in Nigeria, that's a big deal because a huge chunk is spent on that. And they're going to tell you, well, that's money we could spend building roads. Except that Nigerians know that they did that for 20 years, that they didn't build that many roads. So when we create this dichotomy of democracy and good governance, someone else hears it differently somewhere in Africa. That, oh, you see, elections are not nearly as important as giving you food, educating your children, so who cares? To hell with elections. Mm. And then, so I don't want that message to be sent. Democracy is a very complicated process. We struggle with the news in the US. I'm actually very happy for Washington. I'm glad that Africans can now see that the United States is not a very easy country to govern, that Americans have problems with governance, and so that it's a global thing. It's a work in progress. And the key of democratic politics is that eventually you do get it right. But it's not an automatically stabilizing factor. And I think we have to send that message out. Democracy doesn't give you political stability right now. It allows for political space, and my Cameroonian brother mentioned that. It allows for the opening up of political space with the view that the more input you get, the better output you're gonna get. The problem in Africa, I must say, and this is very Weberian, is that processing that input has been very difficult, you know, because of technical capacity. And that's where the work has got to be done.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Okay, Ambassador Sullivan, thanks for being here. You were Ambassador of the Congo. You've had a long career in Africa. You've served in Ghana, you've served in Cameroon, you've served in the Congo, of course. You were in the Peace Corps as well, in Africa, in the Congo, so you've had multiple tours of duty in Congo, which is a very large country, and you're now a Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs, which is one of the most senior jobs in the State Department covering Africa. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be here. I just want to just make a couple of editorial points before you speak, which is that you have a great partner at AID and Ambassador Mark Green, who served as ambassador to Tanzania and used to run the International Republican Institute. We were just talking about political parties and supporting it. So somebody who thinks about democracy, rights, and governance, who's been an ambassador like you, and is now at AID, which is one of the main checkbooks that the United States has in terms of supporting in the combination with the diplomacy that you lead or you're one of the leaders of at the State Department. So thanks for being here. I know you'll have some views about this report and some of the other comments that other folks have made on this panel. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here. Let me just clarify that I have experience in the two Congos. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the former Zaire,
Congo,
and I was ambassador in the Republic of Congo, whose capital is Brazzaville.
So. Fantastic. So this is like one of those Trivial Pursuit questions, right?
Well, there are a couple of things I'd like to start off with for my infomercial. I think that I'd like to say that when the administration came in and there was talk of America First, a lot of people recoiled and said, oh my goodness, something has changed. And I took a trip very early in the administration in March of 2017, and in my conversations with government officials, private sector people, civil society organizations, and even our diplomats, I said, you know, guess what? It's always been America First, just like it's always been Equatorial Guinea first or Nigeria first. Maybe we never quite said it that way, but that's how it should be. And I think people have come to...
America First doesn't mean America alone.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
And so I think people do understand that. The other thing I'd like to stress is that there are decades of broad bipartisan support for Africa policy. And so regardless of who is in the White House, I think we can count on the legislative branch to really continue to emphasize three different main lines of effort. And these might have a slightly different emphasis from administration to administration, but they're always present. And those big three, if you will, are economic development and trade. And that's, you know, you can drill down into these baskets, and I'd be happy to do so. Regional security, peace, counterterrorism, and last but not least, democracy and governance. And I'm curious, I'd be interested to debate with the professor a little bit about that, because I think that the administration is trying to focus more on the good governance piece because of, if you go back to 1990 and French President Mitterrand's speech at La Baule, where he said, we're not going to give, France isn't going to give any more assistance to countries that aren't democratic, everyone scrambled to start having elections. And that was, in many respects, a box-checking exercise that was very superficial. And we realize that's not enough. And I think it's very important for all of us to make that strong connection between governance and providing services to the people, being inclusive, having open political space, fair media, rule of law, et cetera, because it's not just standalone. It's not just let's check the box for democracy in order to get assistance. But when you look at the investment climate, and you can't just conjure up American investors because you want them. They're going to vote with their feet, and they're going to look at the investment climate and how are the local investors treated and how are disputes treated. And what is the sanctity of a contract or a piece of paper or a constitution? And then the amount of services provided to local communities has a very strong impact on security. A UNDP report from last year came up with a figure of 71% of Africans who were radicalized became that way after negative encounters that they or someone close to them had had with security services. So, protecting human rights is not just the right thing to do, but it's also got a very critical role in that cycle of governance and security. So it's really in countries' self-interest.
Great, thank you. Okay, so let me just, I think there's some really smart people in this room. I'd like to hear from some of them. So can I see a show of hands, please? Okay, so let's see. So this gentleman, this woman and this gentleman. Guys, come up here. Microphone, team microphone. And we'll do a couple rounds. This gentleman here, name, organization, and keep it short, okay?
Hi, my name's Frederick Ruiz-Ramon. I run a small consulting business called Persitas International. But my career has been spent both working on the issues of supporting democratic consolidation when there are transitions to democracy, and then subsequently working a lot in investment projects in places like Africa. So I have two questions.
Okay, keep them short, please.
They will be short.
Okay.
First question is, can you talk, and this is just in general for the audience because several people talked about this, can you talk about business creation, in particular small and medium businesses?
Okay, and what's the next one?
Well, let me finish that question because
okay.
It's not sufficient.
This is, yeah, I'm starting to lose patience.
The country in particular, can you talk about country-based capital generation, such as angel and venture capitalists and so forth, as well as the bureaucratic aspects of supporting business creation? The second one is professionalization of bureaucracies. In particular, can you talk about what efforts can be done to professionalize bureaucracy so that you can have governance? And I'm not talking, for example, on the military side of things like technically and tactically proficient. I'm looking beyond that in terms of the culture of the organizations. And I think the ambassador
okay.
hinted
Thank
at
you.
That.
I got it. Okay, who else? I had other, this gentleman here. Name, organization, keep it short, please. Sir.
My name is Kadmana Tamils. I was a former World Bank staff member, and later on became very involved in politics in Ghana. I'm from Ghana, which is supposed to be a very democratic society. My worry is that more and more increasingly, people are beginning to feel that the democratic process doesn't really give real choices. That you have a situation where you have rival contractors, if you want to call them that, rival cronies vying for power, but labor, and I don't mean just simply organized labor, but people who rely on their own labor, don't have a voice at all in the political process.
Okay.
And I would like to know, first of all, what your organization is doing, because I think it's very interesting, and why you don't have more of a presence in Africa.
Okay, great, thank you. Okay, I this woman here, and this gentleman here. Name, organization, keep it short.
Sure, can you hear me? My name is Edna, I do consulting work. My background is in international development, and I'm Ethiopian. And if you're following what's going on now, we're in very interesting times. What's happening now is really more of a reform within the political party that's been in power for 28 years. And so we have this guy now that's very charismatic, our prime minister, our new prime minister. He comes, you know, his father is Muslim.
Yes. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, on paper, he's fantastic. But my question is, seeing the trends before in Africa, when new leaders come and then they're riding this wave, do you see anything different now where you'd say this is different, or is it the same old where they come in and...
So the prime minister has also said he wants to get peace in his time with Eritrea, too, right? The prime minister of Ethiopia. Okay, this gentleman here, name, organization, keep it short.
My name is Alex Magaisa. I am from Zimbabwe. I used to advise Morgan Tsvangirai, who was Mugabe's biggest rival. I'm currently at NED, where I'm a research fellow. Two points, really. First is the military, the role of the military. We know that in Africa there was an era of military coups. I'm from Zimbabwe, so you probably guess why I'm asking. Are we really over that trend? And the second is to Bill and other people who have talked about technology and elections. Some people, some academics talk about the technology fetish. You know, Africans, we've got a lot of biometric voter registration taking place, use of technology. I'd like you to comment a little bit about that, especially in terms of risks and opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Okay. I'm also going to ask Team Nick if they want to respond as well. So why don't we just go down let's start with Bill, and we'll just have each of you respond to whatever you heard, and then I'm going to ask Team Nick if they want to respond to what they've heard. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, let me start off with technology. There is increasing pressure on the electoral process throughout the world to implement more and more technologies in part to substitute technology for people, because people oftentimes come out of the political process and they're not trusted or they're not well trained and don't perform well. The risk of that is a few things. Number one is that oftentimes, particularly in African countries in recent years, the technologies have been compromised by corruption in the procurement process. Number two, oftentimes we've seen election commissions forced to adopt a multiple of technologies in a rushed situation, thus they don't field test or don't have the time and resources and capacity to field test, and then one foot fails and the whole thing fails. So, for example, in Kenya's election a few years ago, they tried to implement 8 different technologies simultaneously on election day. A few failed, the whole system failed.
I'm just going to say that's probably a bad idea, right?
It's a bad idea. It didn't work for the District of Columbia either.
Right.
Nigeria was able to hold the line at 4 technologies. But we're going to see more and more technology in the election process. We also see a global demand for paper records. So that's going to continue. We also see, heightened work concerns about the integrity of the process, because of hacking, interference by foreign powers and others. So this is going
to be
permanent.
That's a thing in Africa too. It's not just a thing here.
It's very much a thing in Africa. It's
right.
Very much
so we're
a thing
just we're
here.
All on the same page.
We're all
right?
on the same
this
page.
This is not just an America
yep.
thing.
No.
This is a thing that's happened all over the world, including
yes.
in Africa.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, Shauna?
Yeah, thank you for your question about labor and elections. We would completely agree that there's a pretty big disconnect between, in most countries, not all, between political parties and other constituencies, including labor. We've been actually working really hard to bridge that gap in places like Kenya, for example, where we helped organize candidate forums with workers so that candidates had to answer workers' questions about what kind of policies they were going to put in place. And you got a lot of disaffected, angry workers as a result of what they heard, which was that, you know, the parliamentarians had never thought of it before. What does it mean to be a minimum wage or low wage worker in Kenya, a domestic worker who works 12 hours a day with no benefits and no social protections and not getting minimum wage? That woman wants to know what that parliamentarian's going to do to listen to her voice, right? So there is a good bit of disconnect in most countries. On the other hand, of course, labor unions have played such an important role historically in democratization in so many countries in Africa, everything from the fight against apartheid in South Africa with the heroic struggle of the black labor movement in that country to end that horrible scourge, to today's movement in Swaziland, an absolute monarchy, where the largest civil society organization in the country is the labor movement, and to Zimbabwe, which has a very long tradition of resistance and building and organizing in the labor movement for political change and trying to hold political parties accountable to better governance. So we try to, where that isn't the case, try to bridge the gap between average workers, normal people, not rich people, people who just work every day, and politicians, and then where labor unions are already stronger and have voice, try to help them organize political asks and demands to represent workers within elections.
Professor?
Sir, thank you very much. I wanted to go back to what the ambassador has said before and just run off with that, with some of the comments. I really am very glad that you guys are working on these kinds of issues about how do you deepen democracy, but also focusing on governance. One of the things we're going to have to learn to do is the metrics. What are we looking for in terms of governance? But my fear about the democracy part, it comes from the question that my brother from Zimbabwe, can I call you that?
Sure.
Just raised. He said, look at what happened in Zimbabwe. We really did have a military coup, right? But it worked in the best possible way that the military coup could work, which is take out the cancer and then bam, let's have something going, right? Very surgical, very, all of that. And I asked myself, if that had happened in Ghana, or Nigeria, what would have been the outcome? Total chaos, absolute mayhem. So the idea that somehow we're going to remove a battle using the military is very tempting. We've tried it in Africa. I hope we stay away from that, because the worst democratically elected government in Africa is better than the best military government Africa has ever had. So that's my response to that, the Zimbabwean thing. Things will work out. But the other thing that came out of Zimbabwe also is the role of China. They did not act until they had consulted with Beijing. And that's very interesting. It used to be Washington, D.C. Now it's Beijing. What's going on? So please step up. Step up. We need you. Okay? The question on small business, I'm going to link that to the issue of governance. We often assume that a lot of the problems in Africa is governmental. And it is. Post offices don't work the way they should and all of that. But much of that is because of the space that you see in the business community. There isn't much investment. Look, these are really poor countries. They're, for the most part, pre-industrial. And I come back to please do more. The Chinese have stepped in the past 15 years and have changed the landscape. It's stunning. American businesses, for the most part, wait for political checks, you know, check democracy, check rule of law, check that and pop. Whereas other investors do not particularly do that. We need to boost the confidence and assurance from various parts of the US government that American businesses, which traditionally know Africa really well with their European counterparts, can do more. Despite the challenges.
So, Professor, you'd like to see the U.S. invest more and be more active economically in Africa?
Economically.
Okay. You know, so, this is beyond the U.S. government.
This is beyond U.S. government.
More trade,
leaders.
More investment.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I was at a meeting 4 or 5 years ago. GE had their annual meeting and invited me in this city. And their former chief executive had made a big push for investing in Africa. Oil, trains, energy. I hope they stay on that path. I don't know what is going to become of that. I ask myself, why don't we see more American companies doing that? Job creation, because the youths in Africa rely mostly on government for jobs. If they had jobs in the private sector, it will relieve the pressure on okay. governments. So that's an absolutely important okay. A point. I thought there was another one. Please, let me just get my... And my colleague in Ghana raised the issue of voice, right? Again, it's that capacity thing, right? I was even surprised that by your question, because I thought Ghana was one of the better examples in our continent, especially in our sub-region. I go to Ghana quite frequently. I love your president, may I say that? I really do. But I think you raise a very important issue, inclusiveness. One of the things I ask myself, and I hope it's part of what my message in my conference in Nigeria, and I'm going to go back next week, I cut it short because of this meeting, is that governments should ask the question of qui bono. When you make a policy, somebody benefits, someone else loses. And we don't very often, at the policymaking level at least, think, how do we compensate the losers? And the primary drag on politics in my sub-region, and I'm coming from Nigeria where there's a lot of fear of intimidation that the president is recontesting and all the apparatus of state, especially the security forces, are going to be used to make sure that that happens, okay? Maybe true, maybe not. But given the history of Nigeria, you bet that that is a very serious fear. But you ask the question of qui bono. Who is benefiting from a particular policy, and how do you allay the fears of minorities? How do you allay the fears of those who are going to lose? We have to think about that very, very seriously. I don't think that we've given enough thought to that. What we see in Africa, and I suspect is global, but it's even more so in Africa, is winner take all, right? If you win, you've won. Everyone else has lost for another 4 years. And therefore, that tension is real. Is it possible to achieve a Pareto optimality, okay. right? So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ambassador.
Where to begin?
Where
Were
to
you
begin?
Looking at my notes?
No.
First of all, let me just say that the United States government did not consider the events in Zimbabwe a coup from a technical definition.
Yes.
We think, yes, there was some military pressure, but it was not a military coup. I would also like to agree with you on this problem of winner take all. And there we get into a little bit of a chicken and egg situation. Like, do the American investors wait till the rule of law is respected before going in? Or do they go in and by example and other pressures induce better democratic governance on the part of a country? So it doesn't have to be sequential, mm-hmm. it could be mm-hmm. incremental. And the issue of winner take all is so important. When government is the only game in town, when you graduate with a liberal arts degree and sit there waiting for 15 years to be hired in the bureaucracy, because that's the correct thing
that's
for your family to
track.
Grow up and yeah. be a functionary, yeah. It doesn't give alternatives. And if it ends up that there is a vibrant private sector, then okay, you try for political victory, you don't win, you go into politics. And if there isn't a lot of corruption in the government apparatus, yep. you might actually make more money in the private sector. So there aren't a lot of role models. And I think that as we talk a lot about passing the torch to the next generation of leadership, but when that torch is laden with the same political culture, then it's really just going to replicate some of the same issues going forward into the sequential
our turn to eat
generations. Yes. Yeah. When shall I?
Okay. All right, good. So Team Nick.
I just
wanted to comment briefly on the question about Ethiopia, and I'm not going to answer the question of is this different than the past, but I did want to highlight that I think it speaks to the title of our broader global trends report, which is Paradox of Progress, right? We see these places where states start to open up a little bit and make changes, but those are also the moments of greatest instability in some of these places, and we see states that have a mix of democratic and autocratic elements being the most at risk for political instability as opposed to a fully democratic or a fully autocratic state. And I think as you raise the expectations of the population about what they might get from their governments, you create real tensions, and we expect to see, not only in Africa but elsewhere, potential pushback, backsliding from governments as they realize, oh, this is more than I can handle, and pushing towards a crackdown. So I just wanted to add that to the mix.
All right. I want everyone to please join me in thanking our friends at the NIC and the panelists for being with us today. Thanks, everybody.